Dear colleagues, I must really start by saying it's really been a wonderful workshop so far, and I must most kindly thank the organizers for the kind invitation. And so the topic which I'll be presenting today is on entangled pneumatic colloids, and this work goes in line with the work in sort of a general topic of liquid crystals and designing complex fields in liquid crystals. So you heard the talk of Jumer on previous Monday, but today I'd like to pick up some of these points and bring them a little bit further and go also a bit of detail and in particular focus on the energetics of these kind of systems. So this is work from Ljubljana, which I've been traveling in this past years also, but okay, so it's University of Ljubljana, Jozef Stefan Institute, and some funding comes also from this Center of Excellence, the Master, which is an EU initiative. So to bring us all on the same page, I'd like to show you this picture just to say, this is, when I say an entangled liquid crystal colloid, this is something we all like us to have in front of our eyes. So here you see some particles, and this is some microparticles, microcolloids. And these particles are dispersed in a fluid, and this fluid is a liquid crystal, which actually produces, generates a complex field. And this field, what it does, it also creates such complex lines, the topological defect lines. Yeah? And the goal of this talk will be, I'll try to show you how actually we can manipulate, or can we actually really design the conformations of these kinds of lines. And at the end, I will convince you that actually we can really make also knots out of these lines. But to make a bit broader introduction, I'd like to start by saying that pneumatic colloids are dispersions of particles, of colloidal particles, in a continuum phase. And why the systems are different, how are they different to other systems, like this continuum phase can be also water or just oil, well, they're special because this continuum phase is a liquid crystal. Huh? And because it's a liquid crystal, it has this special internal structure, you know, so what we should visualize, of course, is these molecules, which at a given temperature or concentration align, we call this direction the director. Huh? You heard this, so, you know, just to recall this basic terminology. But something what I also like us to, so when we try to build up a microscopic picture of this kind of systems, here I'd like to pay notice also to the typical scales in these systems. Now these micro rods, which make our liquid crystals, their typical length is in the range of nanometers. Yeah? So these rods are 1 nanometer in size. But the particles which will be immersing into these systems, they're of the size of micrometers. Okay, so we have three orders of magnitude in between. And it's because of this large difference in scales that we can really treat and consider this liquid crystal as a field. Huh? There are people who are doing very serious studies where actually they have to consider individual molecules. But here, it's because really they have this large difference in scales that we can really think about our liquid crystalline molecules as fields.
But last week, Ryan asked, how is it that you get them to align perpendicular or parallel? And I said it was just magic chemistry.
Okay.
That's
so, for magic chemistry. So yes, magic chemistry. So what is done in order for them to align? They cover them with the experimentalist. Huh? In the back, you have people who will tell you just exactly
magic
which chemicals
chemistry.
You have to mix. But
yeah, I mean, would you just attach chemically elongated molecules to the surface of these particles, and then liquid crystalline molecules they tend to align among them, let's say.
So what?
In particular case, or just
that's just a recipe.
Yes, great.
But how you should visualize this potential, so this chemistry, this magic chemistry, what it does, it grows such spikes, such tiny, effectively such microscopic spikes at the surface. And it's the spikes which point out, and then there's your liquid crystalline rod, it just gets stuck sort of in between these spikes, sort of then you have this homotropic, sort of this perpendicular alignment. So this is kind of a, if you want a microscopic view, it's really these spikes, just sort of how to visualize that. Okay, so it's really that you have this very large difference in scales. Now, just to show you that one can really play with the inclusions and the types of inclusion which you put in, I show you three examples that we worked with in the past years. So here, these inclusions, they were polymer droplets, so clumps of polymer, dispersed in a, this was again a pneumatic and a capillary, and they did all kinds of interesting things, branched, formed chains and all this. You can have rods, or you can have particles which are we call them Janus particles. So the surface is not homogeneous. Actually, one hemisphere is covered with a different surfactant than the other. So you have one surface which imposes this perpendicular alignment, whereas the other, what it can do, it can force the molecules to lie flat. And you have all kinds of interesting bistability and orientations and interesting phenomena in this kind of materials. Okay? So this is, you can really play with the type of inclusions which you put into your system. Now, the main motivation for the work in this kind of materials is to assemble optical structures. This is the work of Ludé and Coulter. So they picked up this work from Poulin, Stark, Professor Lubensky, and Weitz, where they achieved is assembly of droplets. These were glycerol droplets in an emetic. So what you see here, that every this dot here, which you see, this is one microdroplet, a few micrometers inside, and what it did, they formed chains. And surrounding here, this was not a liquid crystal, but it was an isotropic liquid, you would just see a clump. This wouldn't happen. The field changed when a new experimental technique was introduced, and this was optical tweezers. So what you do, you just take laser lights, and you can grab this individual droplet, in this case, this solid B. You can really manipulate them and build structures. Here, they build a cluster, and this is our work where we actually were able to build and explain the a two-dimensional colloidal crystal.
So the colloidal balls are free to move around.
They are free to move around. So what they are usually how the experiments are done. They're done as if you could visualize as if the experiments were done in the display.
So they're sandwiched between.
Sandwiched between, and then the depth or the height of this. Of this sandwich. It can be very different, but this is a typical way how to perform it.
But within the plane of the sandwich,
they're free to move. Of course, how much they actually brownian and move in a brownian way, of course, this depends on their size and the surface potential. So it's all, but yes, they are free to move. Now that you are able to make such structures, they actually have interesting properties. And here I show you just some examples. This is a recent work from Japan where they built such stacks of particles. Well, what they could do, they could imprint defect states into such conformation of particles. So they applied an electric field, and they actually locked in into this state a conformation of this topological defects. So exactly this topological defects which we were speaking about all the time. Yeah? So this is somehow indicates memory capability of this kind of material. This is work from Laurentovic group from the Liquid Crystal Institute, Kent. And what you see here is a capillary. So it's a cross-section of a capillary. So it's a tube which goes like this. And here in the center, you have an electrode. And what they are doing here, well, just by applying the appropriate voltage, and here around them, you have golden nanorods. What they could do, if I may use the sort of a popular language, what they did is to make this electrode invisible. Yeah? So, in other words, in a more physical word, they could tune the transformation optics such to guide light around these electrodes. Yeah? So you could make this. You could make these materials to work as a. Yeah? I won't say invisibility cloaks. Yeah? This is a very popular word. Now, the reason why we are here is because these materials they can be used, so such arrays of particles, they can be used to imprint states of topological defects, which are actually not. And this is something good what I'll talk about. So this is this recent work. Now, so here I brought up this concept of how important are the topological defects and these topological defect lines in colloidal systems. And of course, they are lines, and that's the first way how you can think of them. But I want to show you another idea which we had in the past years, actually how also you can think about these lines. What you have here is again this particle, and this red is this line is a line. What these lines can do, they also trap smaller particles, nanoparticles, if you want. And a structure here showing a calculated figure, but they can do the same thing also experimentally. What I try to show you is that a structure like this can behave as a split ring resonator. Yeah? And a split ring resonator is the basic element of metamaterials. Yeah? So just by decorating these lines, which we are actually not seeing, just by adding smaller particles, doing a sort of a hierarchical approach to these systems, you can transform these lines into sort of line resonators. Or in another way, if, for example, if you put particles which were charged, and they would get trapped into such lines, what would you get? A charged particle put in such a complex conformation.
When you say resonators, this is for a particular wavelength of light?
Yes.
So yeah. What are the relative, what are the dimensions of your large and small things?
This is around 50 nanometers in diameter. So this is above, the estimates we made, they were slightly above the visible range.
But how is it a split ring? It's a solid ring.
You see that actually they don't touch necessarily. So if you put, if you cover them with a sufficient surfactant, they won't touch. So in between these particles, you have a liquid crystal which acts as a sort of a dielectric layer in between the two.
Yeah? See, and so I guess by switching, you can change the dielectric constant.
This is sort of the idea. Yeah, this is
the
idea.
Cover that. Go backwards. I want to see who's on the patent.
It's just in Europe.
Oh, it's just a European patent, so it doesn't mean anything. Okay.
But why is
this? This is our patent, yeah.
So this is a resonator, though, at optical wavelengths.
We don't want to claim that it's really optical wavelength. Yeah, we say it's close, that it's in infrared, but I wouldn't want to claim that it's in optical.
But infrared, but yet it's composed of spheres that are 50 nanometers.
Maybe. Yeah.
So you've done the calculations?
It's an estimate. It's a rough estimate. It's not a real full calculation. So it's an estimate. I don't want to claim too much. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So yeah, this is our patent. Yeah, if you want to reveal it. Yeah. Okay. And well, just if they are charged, what I want to try to sort of give you an image, right? It's not something what we've done, but I think just to think in the direction where we could go. If you put charged particles into such knots, you could have knotted electrodes, something like this. Yeah? So you can really have a way how to make this, how to bring further functionality to these defect lines. Okay, so this brings me to the outline of my talk. And the first thing I'll try to show you is how to generate defect loops in pneumatics. In pneumatics, then I'll introduce you to the pneumatic continuum theory and modeling approaches which we use to describe the systems. And I'll show you that the entangled pneumatic colloids, which are actually the ones which allow you to build different conformations. But in order to really make them, to get the real breadth of these structures, you need an additional trick, if you want, where you stabilize the structures with an external twist, which allows you to make even knots and links. And then I'll try to conclude with two ideas, if you want, or two directions where I believe this liquid crystalline research actually has implications, and where we could also search for interesting topology. So this is blue phases, where I'd like to show you that I believe we can make crosslinks which are more complex than the one which we usually think of. And the other one is the analogy with chiroliquid crystals and chiroferromagnets, so the scrambulons. Now, defects in liquid crystals and pneumatic liquid crystals, and particularly pneumatic colloids, are generated due to confinement. And confinement here, just a cartoon. Here I try to show you a square cavity. And imagine you have a very bright experimentalist who could really impose a pattern to grow a very special surfactant, which will force the molecules to align in this specific configuration. And now, if you pour in the liquid crystal, the field will align, but it's the central point where the order will break. Where the order break and what you generate, this is radial field, you generate what we all know as a plus one defect line. Of course, if the experimentalist would use a different surfactant or a different technique, and he would grow a different pattern on the surface, you would get a different defect, not a plus one. But in this case, you could call it a minus one. Okay. So this is just a sketch to indicate how we get the defect. Of course, the colloids will be more complex, but it's the surface imposed fields which actually compensate. Which, in order for this effect to compensate, defects have to emerge in your sample. Now, how do the real defects in liquid crystals look like? So here, how this defect line looks like. So here, I try to show you one. Okay, so this is an experimental image by Florey. So here, from this point P to Q, this is the defect line. Okay, this is how it looks like. This is a work by Yokoyama from Kent. And so this is an emetic above a nano-grooved surface. And this is how a line looks like, OK? This is an experimental image. This is how this looks like.
What is the image? How do you image them?
So this how they usually image them is this defect line usually scatter light quite strongly, and you can just see them with the naked eye under a microscope. So you just have a microscope, you can see them. Of course, all the other more advanced methods is using polarized light, so cross polarized and so it's position microscope, so microscopy, and then you can extract more from the position of the defects. Okay, so the lines, which will be actually interesting, and these are the ones which are most relevant in the matic colloids, and I'll be showing these all the time, are this -1/2 disclination. So this is the tube, this is sort of the melted core of the lines, and this is how the molecules align around this line. So you have this threefold symmetry, and this is you characterize with this threefold symmetry with what you know as the one-unit number. Okay, so you just measure the rotation along a closed circle around these particles. You divide this by 2 pi, and you get this value. And this minus is because of the it's how we choose directions. Okay, so this is the lines which we'll have. Now, is there another way how to produce these lines in the matrix? Well, if you just put particles into an emetic liquid crystal, well, you get lines just immediately. They're not just lines. Well, I hope you can see this is work by Gu and Abbott. They actually what you get. These loops. And here, maybe I'd just like to show you, just to sort of convince you, why do we really need a line? Why do we need a loop here? So if you have here the particle, and here I wrote that this particle is sort of homeotropic. And this says homeotropic means that it's really this smart chemistry which imposes the molecule to lie perpendicular at the surface. Now, the other property of the pneumatic, which you know of, that it wants to align far away from the particle, it wants to all align in one direction. Okay? Can we now try and draw the field lines of the pneumatic field surrounding this particle? Okay? So if you go here, this is the direction which fits well with the far field. Here, it's just slightly bent. Okay? Same goes up here. So what I'm doing now is just trying to make the field as smooth and as definitely continuous, and I'll try to make as little small perturbations as possible. But when I do this, so my field is everywhere continuous, except here and here. Okay? So if you follow the lines, this is, no matter how hard I try to sort of fit in and draw the field as continuous as possible, I get 2 points where the field is discontinuous. And since this is not a disk, but it's actually a sphere, so this is rotationally symmetric, I get a loop. Okay? So this is how, and this is exactly this loop. Okay? So it's just a simple geometrical consideration of the field lines. You don't need any hard or complicated theory behind this. Okay? And this is the simplest way how to generate loops. Now, can we? But these were just simple loops. Can we make more complicated conformations of loops? And what I show you here, and the process in order to generate these loops, is a temperature quench. So what you do here, you shine with light here in the center, and which heats the local sample in the isotropic phase. So this is an isotropic phase. So this is like a core of the defect. This is a molten pneumatic in an isotropic phase. And what you do next, you just switch the laser off. What happens? You just suddenly generate a number of defect loops. Really, you see, I hope you saw. There are really many. I'll just run this again. You generate many defect loops, but what happens is they all disappear. Okay? But I was just able to access a state of many defects by such a rapid change in temperature at a given spot. Now, actually, we can qualitatively reproduce this kind of dynamics numerically. This is how it looks like. This is a numerical snapshot. This is how it looks like at the stage when there are defects. So you get a spaghetti, or if you want, whichever word you want to use, a very complicated conformation of defect. Of course, this is a transient structure, and this will disintegrate. Now, since we are interested in knots, after hearing your talk last week about random walks, are there knots in such structures produced in quantum dynamics? Of course, this will be transient knots, yeah? They will disintegrate in time. Well, my first guess would be yes, but okay.
How do you generate the initial conditions?
So this is random spins at every point, random spins, and then you let the system relax.
But you have a whole Q tensor. So they may not be transient knots.
Like, yeah. They disintegrate. The structure will align into just a normal pneumatic in time. At least for the runs we make.
But what boundary conditions do you have on the wall?
This is periodic.
You have no walls?
In this case, no. Okay, so no, but I think there's a way how one could navigate around and perhaps really get also a knot here. Yes, I think you're thinking the right direction.
But your experiment has a boundary condition that outside the sphere, it's parallel. Right?
Yes, this is all true. This is all true.
Q has more degrees of freedom than N. Right? Yeah. You're not, so the experiment
is much bigger.
Yeah. Well, I understand it's much bigger, but. So you don't worry about all the other stuff. You don't worry about the boundary conditions on the cube.
At this point, no. I mean, here I just want to show you sort of how in here perhaps how structures look like. Yeah, at some point in time. Yeah? Okay. This is the way how you can actually create complex fields, complex defect loops in pneumatics, with a quench. Now, so sort of introduce you in the theory approach we use. So to describe this fluid, the pneumatic fluids, we use mesoscopic theory of pneumatic, which is based on an order parameter tensor. So you heard some of it. So it's a matrix, and it actually carries 5 degrees of freedom. It's a spatial field. So it's this average orientation of the pneumatic. It's actually hidden here. So this is the director, if you want. So this is the average orientation is here. This S is the degree of order, because you know that these molecules fluctuate, and to characterize this amount of fluctuation, you introduce the degree of order. If the molecules fluctuate close to wall, these fluctuations are asymmetric, and what you get is a biaxiality parameter, and of course with the degree of biaxiality, one of course is associated also the direction, and this is the secondary director. Now, of course, if you have a dynamic system, so if your system is allowed to evolve in time, you're not interested, for example, only in the equilibrium, of course, you also have the velocity and the density fields.
I just want to say something great about liquid crystals, in case anyone's missing it right now, which is that this Q tensor, which is the thing that Landau theory tells you to do, is also the dielectric tensor for the material. Mm-hmm. And so it's really easy to see, right? It's the only material where you have to make no effort to actually see Q, because there it is. You get it from looking at the dielectric tensor. That's why you can see the lines, because those are places where the dielectric tensor is varying rapidly, the dielectric constant, so it scatters light there.
So when you say it is, it has the same directions.
It's the same. You put a number in front of it.
You just scale it. It's just a scale.
Scalar times it is a dielectric tensor.
Also,
guys, since Thomas was here, I know it's called biaxial, but they're really three axes now.
It's biaxial in the sense of the axes that you need
two
to change.
More axes.
No. So the axes refer to the optic axes, which are the directions that you can project the ellipsoid into where it looks circular.
Okay, good. Okay, so it's actually on topic to the transmission.
And in addition to the dielectric tensor, you can also map to this Q also other material properties like a diffusion constant or the temperature conduction. So it's an old tensor.
The picture there is an image of dielectric tensor.
Exactly. Now, having Q, now it's important if one is interested more in an equilibrium properties of a liquid crystal, or you are really interested in the actual dynamics. Okay, because if you're interested just in an equilibrium of a pneumatic, this equilibrium is determined by the free energy. So it's the Landau de Gennes free energy, which can characterize your equilibrium of your system, so the equilibrium of your Q tensor, or the equilibrium of your pneumatic colloidal structure. And actually, what one needs in order to describe the systems is sort of, I'd like to call this, three basic ingredients. Yeah? The first one, if we call this in the liquid crystal language, this is called the effective elasticity. Yeah? So what you see here, so this is Q. Yeah? This gives our average orientation. This is a gradient of Q. Okay, so you have a spatial derivative. So as soon as this Q becomes varies in space, this becomes non-zero. This is squared, so the free energy increases. So this is a sort of a free energy penalty for any distortion which you generate in your pneumatic field. Now, second line gives you what we call an order contribution. So this is a Landau expansion, in particular in the degree of order. And this is a term which lets you, so if the elastic perturbation is too large at a given spot, this term allows you sort of to change the degree of order at a given spot. So this is, if we want to say it this way, this is what allows you to generate defects. Now, since we will be working with colloids, of course, the liquid crystal has to couple with the particles, and so it's this Qij naught, so it's this tensor, which is actually prescribed now at the surface of my particle. Okay, so this Qij naught, and so you see this, it's the difference of these two squared, so any deviation from the surface imposed field is quadratically penalized, and again, this corresponds to this case to a surface free energy. Okay, so this is a way how to characterize the equilibrium of a pneumatic structure. Now, if you're interested in the dynamics of a liquid crystal, so actually if you let your system flow, yeah, and you really want the actual dynamic transformation of your system, actually you have to think about two things primarily. So one is the evolution of the orientation. And of course, the other one will be the actual flow. So yeah, this is the dynamic equation for Q tensors. So here you see that the material derivative, this is here the molecular field, and this is directly related to the free energy, which I showed you just before. Now, this term here, whichever way you would like me to call it, so this gives you how the liquid crystal aligns in flow. Because what liquid crystal molecules can do is that actually they can align in flow. And typically, this is typical if you have longer molecules. Yeah? So if you have longer molecules, they will align with respect to the gradient of the flow at a given angle. And this angle is called the Lessing angle. Yeah? But if the molecules are a bit shorter, what they can actually exhibit various sort of types of motions. So either they rotate or they wiggle. They have a very different ways of the molecular motion which to do. And it's by incorporating this term how you can actually characterize these kind of various molecular types of motions. Now, since this is the dynamic equation for dynamic evolution of Q, you need another one for the flow. And this equation is you will recognize it easily. It's a generalized Navier-Stokes equation. And it's generalized in the way the stress tensor is written. So you see that here, so this stress tensor. So here, so you recognize the pressure, okay, the pressure tensor. But here you have several terms which depend on this Q, so on the rotational field. Okay, so the Navier-Stokes is coupled with the orientational field. Yeah? So this is it's called backflow coupling in liquid crystals. Well, so we know now how to approach the systems, but actually this one needs to also solve these equations, and we do this numerically. So now again, if you're interested only in the equilibrium of your system, you need to minimize the free energy. Take the free energy, take all the Lagrange equations, you get a set of six coupled nonlinear partial differential, you solve them. Yeah? This is how it goes. And you try to do it as efficiently as possible, and this is actually at the background of most of the structures which I'll be showing to you. Now, if you want the dynamics, this is something what I worked with and learned with Julia Yeomans when I was at Oxford, is solve the dynamic equations with the hybrid lattice Boltzmann algorithm. So this is doing a finite differentiating for the Q tensor dynamics and the lattice Boltzmann for the to solve effectively the Navier-Stokes equation. Yeah? This turns out to be one of the efficient way how to solve this kind of problems. Okay, so now we sort of I had to go through this methodological approaches which we use, and now we can really start building structures. Yeah? And you will remember that I can impose and bring new and complex defect state by taking the temperature quench. Okay, I just heat the system locally and I get various defects. If you did this around the particles, you get new structures, and you've seen this. So this is a structure of figure of eight, figure of omega, and entangled point effect. You've seen this in Joomer. Zeumer's talk, and it's really that this conformation of defects, which gets excited by this increased temperature, sort of cannot effectively cannot relax, or if you want to say, it gets stuck at the particles. But there's one important thing with these structures. They are all energetically metastable. And they are metastable with respect to the structure of what is called two Saturn rings. Okay, so here you see two particles, and each is encircled with one ring. And this, people who work with this more will call this solution sort of a superposition of singular solutions, so solution of for one individual particles, where these are really, you know, somehow different. Okay, but it's always this structure which forms. And now, to put some numbers on this metastability, so here again, I showed the stable structure of the two Saturn rings and all the three metastable ones. Here I show the free energies. Okay, so this is free energies in joules, yeah, the ones which are we did the numerical calculations of the free energy, and you see that two Saturn rings have 1.451 10 to the minus femtojoules, okay, 1.456, okay, 1.464, and so on. So you see, I hope you see that this difference is actually very small. Okay? If I express these numbers in my equilibrium, in my stable solution, so here this figure of 8 has a 0.3 higher energy as compared to the Saturn ring, 0.9 and 1.7%. So it's fairly small. However, if you just change the numbers a little bit and actually express these values, you know that the free energy is determined up to an additive constant. If you just write what this 0.3% corresponds to in units of kT, you actually see this day is 4,000 kT higher as compared to the other one. Okay? This is this one, 3,000, this one roughly 6,000. Okay? So this energy states, these solutions which you have, are separated by 0,000 kT. Okay? Now, what can experiments tell us about the systems? Can they help us sort of verify or justify these numbers which I just showed you? So this is what they can do. So here you see two particles. Okay, this is how they do their experiments. Okay, they shine the light. Okay, then they turn the laser off. They get multiple defects and they get a structure. You've seen this movie. Okay, but they repeat this kind of experiment. Yeah. Now they have this structure and they make a mark. Now they heat this two particles again, and perhaps they get a different structure. And they repeat this 200 or 300 times. I think this is what they did. And this is the percentage of the occurrence which they get. So in 52%, they get this structure, 36, 13, and 3. Okay? So you see that it's really the largest occurrence is really, well, the largest probability for the occurrence is really for the Saturn rings, and it goes down the higher the free energy. Now, can we actually really relate this probabilities for the occurrence with the actual energies of the state? This is, I think, an interesting question. Yeah? Because definitely the factor in the probability is not kT. Yeah? So it's this is the closest we could get from experiments.
So is that really telling us that experimentally what's happening is it's a kinetic pathway that's determining what final state we end up in?
Yeah.
Is there something that you can say from your simulations about what the kinetic pathway looks like that evolves towards a given end state? Or can you characterize some kind of differences between kinetic pathways that go in different places? Is that something you can do?
The idea which we have is actually to actually really try to discriminate this kinetic pathways which you're talking about, and to discriminate them with the external fields. So you can imagine that if you apply the right field
to target for
a particular structure, and it's by using complex laser fields, perhaps you could really go. You just help the structure to get this one, not just by probability, but you go in this one.
Are you surprised that they're in the right order?
Pardon?
Are you surprised that they're in the right order, if it's kinetic? What temperature would it have to be? So those would be, is there one temperature where those would be all the right weights?
This was done all at room temperature, so the experiment.
I'm asking, so you have these energies. So suppose you said there's an effective temperature, right? Is there one temperature that gives you this stoichiometry of choices?
Yes, this is all run at one temperature. We haven't tried.
Can I ask you, using the Walden elastic constant approximation, aren't you? So, I mean, experimentally, you could change the elastic constant, and then you can see if changing the energetics that one changes the distribution.
Definitely, and I'm very sure it will. And yes, definitely. I would even speculate. The other parameter, which I think is also very important, is the actual size and the actual confinement of this structure. So how confined are they? Because this structure, for those you know more, right? So this is sort of has internally sort of a structure of a dipole, an elastic dipole. This loop here is actually corresponds to a bit of the point defect in the experiment. So if you can sort of favor the dipoles, and you know this is the case in thick cells, I'm sure that you can sort of bring the energy of this one down in comparison to the other. So yes, so this is definitely, I believe, you could
change this order.
Which one is stable or which one is metastable. But we tried various, and we could never sort of get any of these stable as compared to this one. Okay? This was the problem. We couldn't change. It was always this one. Now, which one is here, the lowest or highest? This is,
So is there any entropic difference between the wiggling of the lines?
We haven't looked at this. This is the first statement. Also, from the experimental perspective, I think they don't see too much of wiggling.
You wouldn't see much,
but a fair answer is we haven't tested
there
this.
There is one difference that each has a certain distance. When they make experiment, distance bound doesn't change because it goes fast enough. So that means one is a little low, one is low. Because calculation means that you get a kind of optimal distance. But when they make experiment, it's one. I think it's no time to adapt the heavy particle.
Yeah. Okay. So. But I told you the structures are actually metastable. And to really actually convince you that they are metastable, I also have to show you the energy barriers. So these states are separated by thousands of kT. I want to show you now also the energy barriers. So this is for the figure of eight, for the figure of omega, and for the entanglement. So they're just going the same line. Okay? And the first thing which I'd like you to notice is that actually these energy barriers, so what you do here, so this is two particles, and sort of stretch them in one direction, or if you try to move them in this direction, okay? So sort of try to tear them apart, and you see that they're strongly anisotropic. So pulling the particles apart in one direction or in the other is just not the same. It's not the same. And the other thing, which I think it's just interesting to notice, is actually that these energy barriers, if I may call them this way, they're fairly strong. Okay? So in this direction, the free energy increases by 10,000, 13,000 kT. Okay? So you have the energy barriers, which are as high as, say, 1,000 or several, or even 10,000 kT, which separate your state from any other. Okay? The states are separated, and this is the barriers between.
That's separate. That's moving them apart, but not twisting.
Not twisting. That's true. Although since we have spherical particles, it's difficult how we would twist them.
The particles are spherical, but the loops go around.
Yes, but we never.
It's just difficult.
Yeah, we couldn't do the sort of twisting, the structure. This is something we haven't tried. We haven't seen these moves, neither in numerics nor in experiments. So this is the principal degrees of freedom which the system has, sort of as a barrier. But in the larger structures, it's a good point. If you have, for example, when I'll show you the clusters, this is definitely the case. So it's the whole cluster which can rotate. In this case, yes, you have to. One needs to test this as well.
So B and C correspond to both those omega states, right?
Yep. Yeah.
Is there some background twist to the pneumatic that's leading to the vastly different? Could you just run back just one slide, just this question. Okay, I can't. So it's figure of eight, figure of omega, and so what's the other one?
Maybe the best way how to see them is here, okay? So this is the figure, this is the side view, okay? Same,
Okay.
working. Well, and experimentalists actually can really probe the systems also, really stretching them in this direction. And we get sort of a qualitative agreement. I won't call quantitative, definitely it's elastic constant, which is the first thing we need to try in order to make this more quantitative. Now, having learned about how to make such more complex motifs of defects with pairs, we can now really do larger structures. And here I try to show you how we can make clusters. So again, you do this magic wrench. And you end up with various solutions of trimers. You can actually do this with tetramers. And actually, now you can do this also in two-dimensional colloidal crystals. OK, so these were really individual particles, like a cluster. Whereas here, this was done with a colloidal crystal, so within a unit cell of two particles. So what I try to show you here is really that these defects, this minus one defect, they can really make very complicated and different motifs. Different motifs, conformations. I wouldn't want to call this yet a different topology. It's just a different conformation of the loop. Now, to again put some numbers on this, so here I show you free energies of these structures, and in femtojoules and energies per unit cell. And I hope you can see here that again we are in the range of a few percents of differences between these different states, although these loop conformations are very strong. Okay, so we have very different states, but the energies are still in a range of a few percent.
So even in the state where you just have where you just have the rings but no loops, there's a degeneracy, isn't there? Because you can choose which way the rings go up and down.
Yes. Yeah.
So is there a preferred relative orientation of the whole thing?
Okay, so here,
make them all sort of go one up and one down, or you could switch them.
So for this case, we always see the loops aligned sort of perpendicular to the director.
So the 1.526, that's individual loops?
Yes, this is an individual loops, yes.
And the 1.42 is also?
No, this is here, you see, they do sort of a chain.
I see, so the chain is a lower energy.
526. Just a little bit higher. Maybe an important thing, if I may mention, so this is run sort of in really to fairly compare the energies of these systems. These particles here are, you can imagine, they are sort of held together. So they have, their positions are fixed. So it's a fixed lattice, if you won't call this an opal. Okay. So as if having an external pressure put on the particles such that they are in this exact conformation.
The ring direction is the pneumatic director.
Yeah, the pneumatic director. Is this.
No, but the lattice is making them really be central going around rather than having a conformation of two spheres. In two sphere conformation, the two rings end a little to avoid each other. Right.
Yeah, but there, that's also the other two. Yeah, so this would be a pair and they would bend. But actually, you have here the third one.
Right.
So it's sort of composite.
So there is a state where they're symmetrically wound, and you might have one where they might want to bend off.
Yes, we've seen those. Yes. But this is the stable one. This is the stable one. Okay, I showed you 2D. Actually, the same works also in 3D. So here, what I show you is now 3D opals. And again, what you see is that you can generate complex loop conformations now for the loop spanning and going through the voids in between now these three-dimensional colloidal crystals. So now, again, so here I won't want to call this topologies. Look, these lines, they are not closed yet. I'll try to call this sort of the spontaneous way what's the system. You need the quench, and these are the systems which you observe. There are many metastable states. I showed you how they are separated in energies. There are strong energy barriers in between them, and this is you have little control which state actually emerges. Okay, there are probabilities which you can emerge. Perhaps you could help them by tuning with trajectories. Now, can we now engineer a way how to really get the exact loop which we want? Okay, and in order to do this, you need first a small trick. And this trick is that you change the, if I may say, a global condition photonematic. Suddenly we don't have any more our cell, which is all nicely aligned. We make a twisted cell, okay? A 90 degrees twisted pneumatic cell. So those of you, if you have at home perhaps some old display, there's a TN. This is a TN display, okay? So 90 degrees twisted pneumatic display. And it's now in this state where actually the structures, this entangled structures, become stable. Yeah? So this is now this figure of eight. Again, this two loops conformation. Here I show you free energies of the two states. And it's now really this figure of eight, which has the lowest free energy. Okay, so this is now the stable state, whereas this is now becomes the metastable state. And experiments, what really happens is that the particles, they just come in fuse. Yeah? So these lines, they just, yeah, if they approach, yeah, they can just fuse. Yeah? Yeah, this is now, and this is the trick which you need in order to really access more complex conformations of loops. Now, going really, and as soon as you do this, and if you're,
just a slide back. So these were observed, and the one before was not observed.
Pardon?
These were observed in experiment.
Yes, this was all observed in experiment.
And the other one were not.
Here in 2D and 3D, this is predictions. Predictions. There's a nice work by Clark group from 2002, where they actually did this kind of systems. But I think nobody really looked into the system to search for the defect states. Okay, so. They looked at this kind of system. Is there are there conformations in there like this? They haven't looked at this. Yeah. This is okay. Yeah. This is observed. Yes, definitely. All right, this is really observed. And having this trick, you suddenly now if you switch to sort of a topology thinking of about the loops. These loops, if you have two loops, you can think about this as an unlink. Whereas this figure of eight can be thought of as an unknot. Of course, okay, it makes a complex conformation, but still, topological-wise, it's an unknot. You have just one loop. Okay? But what you get with this twisted state is also a conformation, and suddenly you have two loops locked into another. Okay? So suddenly it's also this kind of a solution which survives the numeric modeling, and this is the Hoppe-Mink. Okay, so here I'm showing you the first non-trivial conformation which we get. Now, but I haven't told you exactly, actually, how do we get this solution? Okay, how do we get this solution? How we do the modeling? And we didn't do the temperature quench in order to get it, but one needs a little bit of engineering of the solutions, okay, of the fields. And since this is a workshop about complex fields, I want to show you actually how one can tune and play with the fields. So this is the solutions which we get when you do the quench. Okay, so heat the system locally, and you get this solution and this solution. Okay, and now, can you help me? Can I get from any of these two this guy? What should I do? And I not only have the positions of this particle, of these loops, but I also have the full field surrounding. Okay, I have the full numerical solution. What do you need to do? If I cut this solution in half, okay, along this diagonal, and I can do this numerically. Okay, what do I need to do next? Okay. Yeah. You cut it in half, turn it around, and you have the state, which looks like this. And I think this is the real first image of the Hoppe-Mink which we got. Okay, so I was literally taking the picture, cutting it in half, and this looks now like the Hoppe-Mink. Okay, so now if you do this now really numerically, yeah, just have the solution cut in half and glue together the fields. This is what you get. And what I'd like you to notice is this small kinks here. Yeah? Can you see this? And this shows you, this is the amount by which this side of the solution, what's the mismatch between this side of the solution and this side. So although the field looks very different and the loop conformation look very different, actually, when you just when you do this kind of surgeries, you see that they fit together very nicely.
You haven't relaxed it now.
No, I haven't relaxed. I just cutting in half and doing numerics, turning it around.
It's like when people cut your face pictures in half. Your left side of your face looks in half, and your right side looks in half.
Except this one's for the front, because of the back.
Okay, so now. And now I relax this really random numerics with this initial condition, and these kinks, they just disappear. Okay, and in terms of mesh resolution, this is just few mesh points. Okay, so this is few mesh points. So it's very very small difference of the field, and this is now the full relaxed solution. Okay, so you can really do such surgeries with the fields if, of course, they fit properly together. Okay, this is one of the tricks, and this is how we get the Hopf solution. Okay, now again to show a little bit the free energies. So this structure has, okay, this number of femtojoules, and this one has this number of femtojoules. What I hope you will notice here is that now the free energy difference is in the order of, say, 10%, okay, 10%, and it's sort of an experience with the systems is that if you have the states separated by percent, yeah, the states are separated by percent in free energy, it's really this quench which helps you to get the structures. As soon as you're in the range of 10%, as the way it's here, you need to do some other tricks. Huh? You need to do some other tricks. OK, so how does it look in experiments? Yeah? So this is work by Urash. Yeah? This is work by Urash. So again, so you have 4.7 micrometer sized particles in a 6 micrometer thick cell. Okay, thick cell. And if you put these particles just in here, this is what you get. And you look under the microscope, of course. Okay, and what I hope you will notice is these black lines. Yeah? These lines, these are exactly these defect lines which we are after. And another thing which I hope you will notice is that actually these lines, they really make complicated conformations in space. Yeah? They just make strange moves. Yeah? And this is just continuously. We haven't done anything. We just make the system. But if you now engineer the system and do everything a little bit more controllable way, yeah, so I have three particles. I hope you see these dark lines. Yeah, these are my loops. Yeah, okay. And if you know, when Urash did this, okay, he brought up laser tweezers. Yeah, this is this here, and I hope you can see now actually how one can rewire these lines to actually cut the lines and relink them together. Now in a very fairly controllable way. Yeah? Now can you tell me?
So what's the real time scale that's happening?
This is real time. This is real time.
You're fast.
This is real time. Yeah. This is not just with a computer mouse. This is a computer mouse. You can control the laser. Just like, okay. And now, okay. Can you try now and guess? Okay. Of course, you shouldn't see this here up here, right? So what's the structure? Okay.
Figure it.
Okay. So if you now, if I just zoom in here and I draw here not only the defects, but now you will recognize that this is a trifold knot. Okay? Of course, the solutions which we have here, if you try and tear the particles away, of course, the defects won't survive. So the particles, in a way, an inseparable way of inseparate element of the fields which we generate, but in a topological way, it's these states which are really not. So, just in the field, if you take the particles away, I showed you at the beginning, we generated complex defects, but they all just disappear. So you really need the particles to sort of stabilize, to sort of hold these defects in place. Okay? So yeah, here I sort of try to convince you more that these are the right Meissner moves which you need in order to get from here to here, so to get the picture which we usually associate with the trifold knot. Okay? Now, if you work more, build larger structures, you can actually access more complex knots here. See, just by adding growths, Urash was adding growths, and you can really get a whole series of torus knots. Okay, and there will be another talk on this, and actually there's an interesting topology story behind here. Okay, one can do very well classification, many things, and you will hear a talk by Simon on this. But what I would like to, the last thing which I'd like you to notice here is this region. Yeah? What I hope you can see here is these two dark lines, okay, in this exact spot, okay? And the same could be done if you make a circle here or here. So here, these defect lines, they just bypass one another. Yeah? But actually, they can bypass also not only in one direction, but also in another direction, or they can actually also cross. So these are tangles. These are tangles, and by designing these tangles locally, it can really tune and change the topology of these things. Okay? So by playing with these tangles and really transforming one into another, you can really get the knots which you want. To show you the structure, and actually can we get the fields, the full knotted fields, numerically. So I show you here now really the numerically modeled tangles. Yeah? So here, this is the region, and this is the zoom in, how this tangle region really looks like. Yeah? So they are not in the same line, but they are sort of tilted in the opposite ways. And also here, the cross, it's not a simple cross. Yeah? So you have actually the full conformation of the effective space. And how do I get the field now? Well, I showed you that just by cutting and gluing the solutions together, I can now really generate fields of an actual knot, not really the full spatial field of various knots, just by gluing the solutions. OK. So if you will allow me now a few more minutes, okay, I want to show you now these two directions which I promised you, where I believe we could look for also for an interesting topology. Okay? And the first system is liquid crystal blue phases. So far, you remember the material which we had these rods. Okay? And now, in order to get these blue phases, these rods will now have to become chiral rods. Okay, so if you have chiral liquid crystal molecules, what they do, they will twist, and the generic phase which forms such materials is a cholesteric phase. Okay, so the molecules, what they do, before we had this pneumatic, all aligned, now what they do, they twist in space. However, if the pitch associated with this twisting is fairly small, then small means a few hundred nanometers, actually what the molecules start to do, they start to twist in more than one direction. And the phase which you get is called the liquid crystal blue phase. It's one of the complex phases. Well, why it's blue? Because it looks blue, okay? Because it looks blue, and what's special about this phase is that actually this is a fluid, but it has a unit cell. It has a qubit unit cell. It's a fluid, okay? And if you could look in, you see that actually it consists of a lattice of the defects. And actually, it's exactly these same defects which we made the knots from. Okay, so this is now a unit cell, and actually there are two types of this arrangements of these lattices. So it's the blue phase called blue phase one and blue phase two. Okay, so it's exactly these defects, but now they appear just spontaneously in the phase. You don't need to generate. You don't need the particles. They're just there. Okay, they're just there. And so I'd like to say that they're sort of natural progenitors of defect lines. And now what happens if you now add particles into a phase like this, I'd like to say that if you add a particle in here, actually what the particles can do, they can split the molten core of the defect line. Okay, not the full directive profile, but actually you have here the particles, it goes close to the line. What you see is that now suddenly the line goes in three ways around the particle, so I'm able to split the line. Yeah?
So what are we seeing there now? What's that, the dark brown thing?
This is the defect line, the minus one half defect line. This is a 40 nanometer sized particle.
And the line just stops, or what?
Now the line is held spinned top and bottom. Yeah? And this is time, if you want. Okay, so the particle gets trapped into the defect line.
So you have two tetrahedral junctions, one above the colloid and one below. So you're not showing all of the one. Why does it just stop?
Stop where? Here. Yeah. This is time. This is time.
It's a boundary?
This is an illusion of time. This is an initial condition, and this is.
But still, in each picture, it ends at the bottom. Why does it end?
This is the bottom of the cell, if you want.
Bottom of the
cell. Okay, so it's pinned at top and bottom because otherwise, it has to be pinned. Yeah.
So there's three things coming around the bottom.
Yes, correct. There are three things coming. Yeah.
Considering exactly. The chart.
So
yeah.
It's exactly the same as the center ring, which was here. Round with the particles. Here you have this one.
We have, if you want to call it, a tetrahedral junction. Now, however, if you use a bit of a different particle, okay, you can now not split the core, but what I'd like to say that you can cut the core of the discrimination line. So here, again, we have these defects, and you see that suddenly these defects, they just end at the surface. Okay? Again, this is just the core of the defect, which is cut, not the field, not the field profile. Okay? And the parameter, which actually brings you from the splitting regime to sort of the cutting regime, is the surface, is the strength of the surface interactions. So it's the surface anchoring. Strong interactions here, weak is here. Okay? So you can sort of tune between the two.
I'm sorry, go back. This is homeotropic anchoring or planar anchoring?
This is homeotropic, yeah.
What's that one?
This is, I think, also homotropic, but very weak.
It doesn't
matter.
So
it's
planar.
It's homeotropic, but it doesn't matter.
Yes.
So it's planar.
No.
So it's hitting the thing planar, right? The 4 minus half defects are hitting the surface.
Yes, yes, yes.
Planar.
Close to the surface, because the anchoring is so weak, they're
just coming in planar.
Coming in planar, yes. But the core of the line ends there, yes. And here it works both for planar and homotropic. Okay. Now, but what happens if you put large, particles into arrays of into the blue phase, like here? Well, this is something what I'd like to show you, and to me it looks interesting, huh? So we hit here, put a large particle into the structure, and I'd like to call this from an. And now you see that actually such particles generate a large, like a whole structure of defects which have to sort of accommodate this intrusion of this larger particles. Again, you see this tree, forearm junction, whichever word you would use.
Aliens. Yeah. Those are aliens.
And I'm not sure if that formation of a topological cage. That's a good word. Okay. And this is the structure which you get a larger anchoring strength. Okay. So you can really get complex defect state. Now, the last thing which I want to show you is the analogy between liquid crystals and chiral ferromagnets. So yesterday, we heard about the skirmions. So this is a skirmion, and skirmion is a profile in the magnetization field. Okay, magnetization, M is the magnitude, N is the direction. This is the kind of a structure which can emerge in chiral magnets. Actually, there are other, depending on whether you vary only the magnitude or just the direction. Okay, so there are various types of skirmions, baby skirmions. Okay. Now, and why are these kind of systems interesting? Well, they're interesting because they form actually in lattices, and they observe lattices of such complex, spontaneously formed complex magnetization profiles. These objects, their dimension is typically in the range of several 10 nanometers, so 20 nanometers, and sort of the sell point of this kind of research is that they want to make these skirmions into bits of hard disk, okay? Because they are so small, actually just by applying pulses of magnetic field, they can reverse the direction of the skirmion, you can get a bit one, bit zero state, okay? This is sort of why this is the claim, why this kind of materials are really exciting. Now, where do liquid crystals fit into this story? Well, the structures which I just shown you, some of them, well, actually, they can be explained somewhere. Some structures were even predicted by actually free energy calculations. So this is a free energy of a chiral ferromagnet, okay, magnetization. So here you have the gradient of the direction of the magnetization, gradient of the magnitude, okay, and this chiral Dobzhinsky-Moria term. Now, if I write down the free energy of a chiral magnetic liquid crystal, this is how it looks like. And if you remember, this energy looks like fairly similar to the one which I showed you right in the beginning. Okay, it has here some chiral terms, yeah? But actually, this is a very standard thing, when looking at chiral liquid crystals. But this free energy, if I now rewrite it using just really the direction of my liquid crystal and the magnitude, okay, this is in the liquid crystal language, they call this uniaxial approximation. Okay, you will actually see that you can get a completely analogous form of the free energy of the two systems. Okay, here you have a gradient of the director, gradient of the direction, gradient of the S, gradient of M, S squared, M squared. there's not the S3 term, and this is an important point, which I'll point out in a minute. That's the fourth term. They actually also get exactly the Kyle term. Okay, so you have a very strong analogy between the systems. And it's just by mapping the parameters when you can bring one system into another. However, we don't want to claim too strong of an analogy, because there's an important difference between the Kyle ferromagnets and the liquid crystals, and that is that magnetization field is a vector field, whereas the liquid crystal director has this n to minus n symmetry. So it's not a real vector field. Okay? So this is the reason why we don't have here the m cubed term, yeah? But we have it with here. So it's not. So we won't get exactly the same defects in one system, and the other. Okay? So this 1 minus 1 half defects, which we are playing with, you cannot see them in the ferromagnet. Okay? But just to show you that actually there is some go along this line, okay, I want to show you structures which in liquid crystal community they are called bubblegum defects. Okay? So they won't be exactly scremions, but I would like to call them similar way. So if you look at the minus 1 defect line, not the minus 1 half, but now minus 1, okay? Now here, with a singular core, what a defect like this can do, it can escape into the third dimension. So that in order to relax the deformed core, it escapes in one up or down, and you get an escape in the third dimension. So why is this relevant? Well, this kind of structures can be observed in liquid crystals. It's actually these kind of loops which can also be observed in pneumatic colloids. So you have now a loop with a cross-section of a minus 1 defect line, which goes down like here, and we can actually make crystals of this kind of structures. So this is not, so this would be called in the same language, would be an escape of a plus 1 line. Here we have a minus 1, but I think there's a fairly strong analogy between the two systems. Okay, with this I'd like to continue, and thank you for your attention.
Would anybody like to ask any questions?
So a comment. That last structure, if you go back to that escape to the third dimension, is exactly like the contact structure. That's what you're about. Contact structure.
So this blue phase is a contact structure. That's something where end up curl n never vanishes. But it's a weird thing because I don't think we know of any blue phases where end up curl n is everywhere not vanishing, which doesn't have defects except for the boring colesteric, which is not showing.
I thought this picture was cylinders.
No, but you can't fill space with it.
Oh yeah.
Right? So you get these defects. Right? I guess you wouldn't even call those defects, would you? Minus one.
Well, here presumably there's no part of the texture that's actually singular.
True. Right. Exactly true. So there's no region which is singular if you want to sort of.
And yet, apparently, the magnitude of the order does dip enough for you to be able to draw an isolated surface.
Is this
another one of your tricks?
This is another one. This is not the degree of order.
So that picture shows.
Not the degree of order. Yeah, this is not the degree of order which we're showing. So this is a geometrical parameter.
Okay.
So we have to show the sort of the center
the
of
order
the
order doesn't really dip very much.
Yeah, the order varies by a percent. If you want to, what we see in the numerics, so it's the order of a percent is the change in the degree of order.
Did I miss it? There's no such thing as an escape minus one and defect line don't go together, right?
Well, there's no singularity.
But yet the presence of the sphere stabilizes, at least metastably, a structure that should have escaped.
No, they're escaped.
It is escaped. So this line which you see here, this is just to show you the center of this structure.
Exactly.
So it's not a singular core. It's not a defect.
Right. That was the point.
But as you move out, it goes from pointing here to rotating in a plane like the edges of your picture there, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
In other words, I mean, normally you say the whole thing escapes.
True.
Right. But
here they escape along the loop.
They escape along the loop, but other forces cause them to bend out and have a structure which is like a plus one as you go away.
There's no plus one.
You're saying you go around the circle. If I go around, if I look at his picture there with the, you know, the red guy pointing out, and on the side they're in the plane, then if I look away and go around, it looks sort of like a one, even though it escapes.
But one has charge zero. There's no charge.
I know, but it's still, you know, if you look at the structure, it looks like you're going around two pi, right, when you go far away.
But that's not topology.
I didn't say it was topology. I said it has to do with the fact that you have the spheres there that are stabilizing the structure, which were left alone, everything would just go up.
So that's what I was trying to get at. So even though particularly without the spheres, you have defect line, you're saying this is a triply periodic structure.
Well, this would be doubly periodic. Without the spheres, it would just be singly periodic and be a Coulomb.
No, without the sphere, without the spheres, you would get a twisted cell. This is made in a twisted cell. This is not a blue phase.
This is not a blue phase. You get a Coulter.
A twisted cell, not a really a Coulter. This is an emetic in a twisted cell. Okay.
These guys are similar to these turons also in the this Evans work, but they were instead of particles, they had two defects on the side. It was a different. This was, I think, was a plus.
Yeah, just the opposite.
So this should be a tight contact. As far as tight is the one with no read truth, right? So this would be tight.
Where it is. The moment I'm seeing it in.
That's one point.
Still a point. And it's a torus crossing interval.
Metastasis.
It's a torus crossing interval. That's what I'm trying to say.
But it's constant. In layers, it's the director all points in one direction. And then it rotates from top to bottom. It goes through pi over two twists. So it's you know, if you did a twist, you would identify it would be S1 across the plane.
Mm-hmm. But it is doubly periodic in the plane direction also with your
only because he puts the colon.
But that's what I wanted to do with the colon.
This is beginning to break up into some discussions. Anybody want to talk about raise anything for that entire group? I noticed that the other groups are probably eating the cookies right now. I want to say we're going to walk away from the big. We will be returning after the cookies. So, but does anyone want to raise any other questions with me now?
Great.